Welcome to the Signals Podcast, a monthly transmission of future frameworks for cross-cultural design. I am your host, Elijah Vargas. To build a more inclusive, accessible, and global digital future, we need new frameworks for technological development. Every month, Signals broadcasts insights from visionaries at the forefront of creative inquiry and design innovation about how emerging technology can support cross-cultural connection. What do cultural production and co-creation look like today? What about in 2050? What does cultural exchange mean in the digital age? How do technocultures contribute to or corrode a shared global cultural exchange? How can the nascent technological domains of artificial intelligence, extended reality, big data, and Web3 contribute positively to the planet? Can technocultural exchange tackle the pressing crises of climate change, xenophobia, assault on women's rights, and the crisis of imagination facing the world today? From the San Francisco Bay Area and beyond, these are some of the questions we will tackle. The initiative Sea Change is implemented by the Goethe Institute San Francisco in cooperation with Gray Area and funded by the Foreign Office of the Federal Republic of Germany. My guest today is M. Effler, aka Blink Pop Shift. Welcome, M. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm great.
So thanks a lot for joining the Signals podcast with me today. On your website, you describe your work as queering disability through technology and found objects. Can you explain this? And in what ways can technology queer disability?
Yeah, so I came to this as like my headline about all the things that I do because I was trying to think about how to describe sort of a bunch of different kinds of practices that I do all together. And one of my main like artistic or creative modes is I'm disabled and I want to know what that means. It's very hard to define disability. It's very hard to sort of define disability culture when people can be disabled in a lot of different ways, or they might not identify as disabled, but instead identify as like experiencing disability socially, things like that. There's like medical models and social models. There's all these different ways to think about disability. So I really wanted to explore like my specific experiences with disability and how they can create ways of thinking, create knowledge, create ways of knowing, create like sort of different lenses on the world that wouldn't otherwise exist. So an example would be I'm most well known for making computational prosthetics. Sometimes these prosthetics are the thing I literally wear, like masking machine, which is a piece that I built that is like a screen that hovers in front of my face that I wear on my chest and I walk around wearing the screen. The screen masks my face and simulates eye contact for people in a social setting. So it combines sort of the AR experience of seeing people filtered on Instagram with the physical experience of like reaching out and holding someone's or shaking someone's hand from behind a screen. As an autistic person, it's interesting to experiment with like people have a very concrete understanding of eye contact. What does that mean for them? What does it mean for me? What is our experience like when they have eye contact and I don't, because I'm just looking at a camera, but they're looking at eye contact on the screen. So experimenting with sort of my disability in that way. Or the other good example is prosthetic memory, which is the piece that won the Ars Electronica Starts 2020 Prize honorable mention in 2020. That piece is an experiment with my long-term memory loss, where I built an AI that uses like my journals and my videos and all this data about me to construct a simulation of reminiscing, which is not something I can do. I don't have like a long-term memory where I re-experience my life story or things that have happened to me. So I built this prosthetic to let me experience what other people might experience as reminiscing. So those are the kinds of things where I'm experimenting with my disability through technology.
Wow. You know, I mean, you just ran through so many different things there. I think what I'm most curious about is how do you come to the particular outcomes as a result of like all of these really complex questions? How do you come to working in AI maybe from the start? How do you decide to link that to even the relationship of embodiment and disability, for example, is not necessarily like an intuitive, might be an intuitive outcome for you, but like in our society, it's not. We don't treat disability as a complex mode of existence in a mainstream sense, right? So obviously that's not a good thing. but I think you're exploring so many different avenues to kind of ask these questions. How do you even come to these avenues that you ask questions through?
So I have developed over the past like 10 or 15 years an iterative, sort of like iterative, recursive, experimental process. And I use this process for most of my projects. I use it for everything from like the computational prosthetics to even like drawing projects. Like I'm working on a hybrid drawing project that's both physical and digital. I start with very simple ingredients. Like for prosthetic memory, the very simple ingredients were I have videos and I have journals and I have a specific set of skills. And my collaborator who I work closely with, Steve Settlemyer, who is my husband, also has a specific set of skills and is interested in a specific set of things. So we take those ingredients like you would for any cooking recipe and sort of like lay them out and take parts of them and stick them together and sort of look and see like what happens when those two things are together. So when I took the journals and I started experimenting doing the thing manually that the AI eventually did later, I realized that when you have the notebook open and you're looking at a specific page, and the video is playing in front of you, it changes both the way you relate to the video and the way you relate to the book. And I also realized showing this to other people before I ever had the AI working at all, I could just show the notebook and the video to people and they would have an experience of reminiscing that I also had. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. So is this sort of, I always relate it to a cooking process because I love cooking. So like there's experiment. I was like, if you put these two ingredients together, what does it taste like? If you put these two together, what does it taste like? You know, you're adding ingredients and removing them in that way. And eventually you find a flavor route that you want to go on. And fortunately for me, my partner had been really interested in working on AI and he'd taken all of these classes and had all this experience. And so that's when we were like, oh, okay, well, what would happen if we added YOLO as an ingredient to this sauce? And that's how we got to prosthetic memory. Some people experience their art practice as this thing they see in their mind, and then they recreate that in the world. That is not at all my experience. My experience is that we have ingredients, we have experiences, we have environments, we have skills, we have tools. And if we recombine them in different ways, we arrive upon flavors, I guess is the word we're going to use. We arrive upon flavors that I wouldn't have expected in the first place, but eventually become like a very interesting path to follow.
You work across so many different mediums, as you've said, both virtual and physical. And so I want to ask you about the relationship, say, to your weaving basket making practice that you've had. This is a more playful question, though. You're winning with your food metaphor right now. Have you actually used food in any of your work?
I have never used food in a performative way or in a way that an audience could participate in, but it is the primary way that my partner and I develop a collaborative relationship. So like he and I work close, very closely together on making food, and we've learned how to collaborate and communicate, especially being, you know, two autistics married to each other for, you know, 18 years now or something. We've had to learn how to have a marriage and how to have a collaborative relationship. And we've done a lot of that learning through food and learning to express feelings that maybe you didn't learn how to express as an autistic kid who didn't have any research, like that kind of thing, where we've been developing that. So the food is more of a tool that we learned through, as opposed to like a material that I've used in the work itself.
Is that like everything you just explained? Is that something that you actively think about? Like that was beautiful. I'm so glad I asked you that question. I mean, that's a really incredible lesson in terms of the distinction between like practice and process. And obviously sometimes they're not different, but like that's a wonderful example of how a process can inform a practice when they are different.
Yeah, it is something that I think about, especially like recently I had a friend come over for the first time in 2 years. and she cooked the food when she was here. And I intentionally observed the difference between my cooking with her and my cooking with Steve to see sort of like how I communicate differently with different people and how that collaboration works. So I definitely observe it very intentionally. And I think that he and I especially have talked about it as like part of our learning, how we learn to be humans.
Or to...
It's hard being a human.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Creating what the human is as one goes. I'm charmed by your description so much. Again, like this has me thinking about your weaving practice, your dancing practice, all of these different physical activities you do. You talk about collage a lot, and you seem to have a way of talking about physical processes and digital processes that aren't particularly separate from each other. Like, at least the dividing line is maybe more of the method than it is like whether something is digital or physical, whether something is an algorithm and a series of rules, or it is a dance floor and a sequence of bodily movements.
Mm-hmm.
Just talk about that with us a little bit, because I mean, you are queering disability through technology, and as a result, you like make these incredible stamp pictures and dance movements and collages. How does that happen?
I think that, at least for me, this is probably different for other artists, but for me, digital is physical, and like physical is sort of the ground plane on which things happen. So when you add ink on paper to it, or if you add finger painting on your phone to it, or if you add music and movement to it, it's the internet is not like a separate thing from you that happens in like a magical plane where your body doesn't exist. So the body comes first because it's the instrument and the material through which you experience and sense the world. It's the only way that you can really sense the world. And any sensory experience that you come up against has different effects on the body, and the body has different interests in it. And you can sort of do it in different environments with the body. So for me in particular, I love rules. My brain loves rules and systems and things like that. So often I will set up a framework that has to do with rules. It might be these drawings can only be a size that's smaller than the book you're currently reading and be done in ink. So that's like one very specific rule that happened in a recent project. And the reason this rule came about is because I have a brain injury. That brain injury means that I spend about 30 hours extra a week in bed. And in order to incorporate a drawing practice into my life, I have to be able to sort of what I call like fit it into the cracks of the pavement of my disability. Like you can think of little dandelions like popping up within my disability. So the rule arrives from the physical realities that I'm currently enjoying. And so once I have a rule, then I can add on to it another rule. And sometimes the extra rule will be physical and sometimes it will be digital. So sometimes when I add on to the rule of like the drawing must be smaller than the book that you're currently reading so that I can draw against the book that I'm reading while in bed, then I'm like, oh, well, my phone is here too. Okay, new rule, you can take a picture of the drawing and augment it only using your phone, no computers allowed, because having a computer, I mean, you have to get up and go get it and then turn it on and this whole process. No, you have your phone right here. We'll just add that one step. And that's a lot of how my like physical digital processes get mixed together, is that they start in that ground plane of the body and then they like layer on top of each other into these like recursive systems that I talked about earlier.
In 2017, you wrote a Medium article. And one of the reasons why I'm going back in this time is because I also want to think about how you're thinking about these things now. 2017 mm-hmm. feels like a million years ago.
Uh-huh.
So in this Medium article titled, "You're Doing Mixed Reality Wrong," you wrote, "In order to make immersive wearable computing an all brain, all body tool, we have to take on design problems both inside and outside the headset. We are not just creating a new piece of software, but a new way of working with computers with our bodies. I call this new way studio metaphor, finally replacing desktop metaphor for good. And you talk about this in terms of variable viewpoint computing. In 2022 now, where the metaverse actually exists as a thing, and the idea of wearable VR headsets has kind of gone into the mainstream of gaming and just culture writ large, is immersive design and wearable computing doing a better job at that?
No, not at all. I don't think I was wrong, but I think I was naive because I didn't factor in make a giant pile of money. I agree with the person writing that like in an ideal world, like where you want to make things that are like really generous to people and like really inclusive, like that is the way that you should go about it. But I think I didn't incorporate business motives and attention grabbing motive. It isn't a full worldview because it doesn't incorporate those things. And I don't even know how I would really incorporate the two of them now, but I do feel like there is a way to use computers, whether that's headsets or phones or desktop, there is a way to use them that doesn't feel extractive of the people using them.
That's a very good word choice.
It's difficult to get it into large platforms because those large platforms are controlled by giant piles of money. So,
do you have changed thoughts about how such variable viewpoint computing could happen now? Or like, if the goal is towards breaking down an old paradigm of what computing is for the purpose of radically transforming how human computer or human machine relationships happen, and maybe like in this queering sense of challenging what it even means to link perceiving bodies with machines and what kind of expressions can come out of that, given the last 5 years and also given COVID. I mean, when I read that bit, one of the things it made me think of is like COVID destroyed any kind of thinking around the idea that virtual space could be an embodied experience. It became all about a way to connect geographical proximity during a period of social distancing. So that whole conversation kind of went away.
Connection across geographic is like, you know, it's an important part of an embodied experience, but we lost the part where this, even the simple things of like, when I look over my shoulder, what happens? Or if I am a person who doesn't look over their shoulder and is laying down looking up because they're on a pillow, like how does this interface like accommodate or is malleable to physical realities? And I think because people felt so isolated that we lost the part where like the first part of not feeling lonely is connecting to yourself. And the first part of using a computer or any computational device in a way that is enriching is about connecting to yourself and your intentions, because otherwise you end up in these extractive relationships. Like, I can't use TikTok. It's against the rules, because if I do, it will numb my whole brain. Like, I fully understand that. So I had to, you know, like you have to build these relationships with the tools that you use. Anytime a tool is made, the first thing that happens is like, we have this technology, it can do this thing, how do we use it to be a product? That's like the pipeline. And I know that people want to shift to, there are people, we're going to call them consumers in this case, because they're products, where there are people and they have needs and problems, and we want our things to serve those people. And that's often called like customer focus, right? In the big tech world, it's called customer focus. But it is very difficult to actually start there, to actually start with bodies and problems and needs and like accommodations, because we are so used to starting from the other direction. All of the pressure is coming from that way. So that's part of why like my artistic practice the way it is, because like it is my tiny little way of like shoving under that pressure wave of technology first thinking and being like, well, yeah, but we could think about bodies first if you wanted.
Yeah. In the most profound sense, we don't really know what bodies are, right? Like there are these historical descriptions that describe what like a bipedal human being is, but that science is built off of concepts that has particular histories that are exclusive mm-hmm. of other histories. They're located in particular moments in time. They're written in specific languages. They use particular frameworks of knowledge production to articulate, which might mm-hmm. be rigorous and might be grounded in big systems of verifiable information, but exclude other systems of verification as a result. So there seems to me to be that kind of question too, which is simply like, when we get confronted with a product that's for a body, sometimes the first question should be, what body?
Yeah, and can you make tools for your body? Are we building systems that enable you to do that? In the case of prosthetic memory, open source led to my ability to make a tool that was just for my particular body. And that required a lot of skills and resources that not everyone has access to. But it was my, it's mine. It's, you know, it's designed for one. It's only for me. I mean, other people get to see it in the museum and stuff, but it was only ever intentionally designed for me. And almost all of my work works that way. I don't know if you've read the book Sickened, but it's all about how Big Pharma uses the image of doing science to produce about 70% of medical research in the United States today, almost all of which has cooked data in it, meaning that like they erase data, they change things about their studies, all these things. So we use the image of science and the image of this like objective system. I'm using air quotes because you can't see them because this is a podcast. We use that image to sort of like create universalizing knowledge that only lets things go in like big directions where it applies to everyone. And we definitely didn't cook the books on this. Whereas I think in art practices and in small practices, you can point like very hard in the other direction and be like, no, actually a tool can just be used by this one person and that's fine in this one context. And it might inform other contexts around me and other disabled artists or non-disabled people who are interested in like building tools for themselves. But it requires like a reframing of like, what is valid information? What is valid knowledge and valid knowledge making? And that's honestly, like that is the core of my art practice. Like I want to prove to myself and to others that like, this is valid knowledge making. That what I am doing is, I'm not creating like a fantasy world. Like I am showing you proof of the value of disabled lives and disabled minds and autistic minds and autistic lives. Cause like, you know, it's not like the Nazis didn't kill us first. I was like the experiment. Sorry to bring up shitty history, but like that is a thing that I am trying to live against in my work, is that idea that like there is one knowledge, there's one people, there's one normal, there's one way to be, and anything outside of that is an invalid way of doing knowledge making. And we know from women and from Black people and from queer people that like that's not true. There is no universalized knowledge. You know, reading Indigenous science practices is like mind-boggling because it completely changes the way that people relate to data and to getting information about the world. So yeah, I really want to participate in that. And I see that in a lot of places. Like I just said, I want to participate in the flow of that, of creating very small kinds of knowledge making that are still valid.
Thank you for saying that. I mean, yes, because this is a podcast, no one can also see me shaking my head in agreement with you pretty much everything that you're saying. I mean, you have very succinctly summed up, I think, what amounts to one of the gravest problems of the contemporary moment. And you pointed to some very real avenues for solving those problems, some of the trajectories for where those questions are being answered. I hope this isn't lost on everyone else. I happen to spend a fair amount of time thinking about these things, so I'm attentive to this. But the relationship between radical disabilities work, Indigenous science scholarship, feminist studies, multi-species scholarship, certain avenues of anthropology. These areas are all linked by these really important questions that challenge the paradigm of what knowledge production means. The question what? I mean, like, ontological thinking is something that's very important to me. And that's getting a bit into the weeds of certain philosophical traditions, I suppose. But most of the time, when you ask the question what something is, you also have to ask the question, by what measurement? And and what are the histories of those measurements? How do they come about? How do the normative terms for whatever those measurements are become established? They tend to all be quite colonial. That tends to be the bottom line. And so I'm very grateful for you and for the people like you who are doing this work and somewhat uncompromisingly. One of the other people I've had on this podcast is artist and scholar Dorothy Santos. Dorothy is also the current executive director of the Processing Foundation. And in my conversation with Dorothy, some very meaningful discussion came up around assistive, specifically in Dorothy's context, assistive audio technologies, but just in general, assistive technologies and open source. And you mentioned this briefly. What is your relationship to open source software in the context of this work? And you said you're relying on like work that other people have done. And one thing I take away from you saying that is the various libraries, the various languages, the various work in open source communities that have been done to build your own tools.
First, if you haven't listened to Dorothy's podcast, 5 and 9, it's about sort of tarot and magic and career and life. It's a beautiful podcast. I really love it. But okay, open source. Whenever you're making with something with technology, or even if we're just making a basket and there's no computers involved, like, I'm dependent on the work of previous people who have done really amazing things that I get to like build on and copy from and like imitate all these things. But open source specifically, if there weren't open source models like YOLO V3, you only look once, which is a computer vision model that was trained to look for basic objects in a scene, like that's a dog and that's a person and that's a car and that's a streetlight. If that model wasn't available, I never would have been able to build my prosthetic project. If there weren't open source spatial tracking models that let me sort of like on a very small computer, run a very fast model that could track my face, like every frame of a video, and be able to modify what's being on that video. If those things weren't available, none of my projects would exist. Even when I'm running on closed sourced hardware, open source software gives you access to tools that have been built in academia, which is where most of the, you know, machine modeling or machine learning models come from. It's not only the tool itself that you're getting, it's this sort of like rich tapestry of all of the ways that other people are also using that model. And so we're all sort of like looking at the same software and seeing it through all of these different lenses. And it goes back to that sort of non-universalizing worldview that we talked about earlier, where niche worldviews get to turn things into different the same materials into different outcomes. And that's what happens in open source, is all these different people use it in ways that I would never have thought of, because that's not the worldview or the problem I'm trying to solve, or it's not, you know, like my physical experience, but I still learn from them. And when you get to learn from what other people's outcomes are when they're based on the same sort of material basis, like a model that you're working with, or in the case of the basketry that I've been working on, just like literally the textiles and how people have shaped them, it means you get to like step 20 steps forward in the video game of making your project. You get to skip a lot of experimentation that people have done in a bunch of different branches. You get to pick a branch and be like, okay, I'm gonna jump forward from there. And then you get to return what you've done to open source, and someone else can look at your thing and, you know, jump forward in the branch again and branch again and branch again. And it's just that, it makes me so happy. It feels like the way that all knowledge could really be used is like the way the open source software is used. We have this model in science of like peer reviewed. And in science, it means a very specific thing. where like I am an expert in this field and you are also an expert in the field because we both have PhDs, and that means that you can review my work and say that it's valuable. But in open source, peer reviewed means I'm new here, but I get to like look at what all of these other people are doing and sort of jump in and vote in my value where I think there's value here, even though I'm not an expert. And then as I participate, I become an expert. And I think that's similar to what like some indigenous scientists have talked about when peer review is when you start science in the community, and the community is the one that sort of says what should be researched and says how it should be researched and says how data should be shared. There's these different models of how peer review happen. And I think the one that's happening in open source right now is just like really beautiful and has helped me personally make things for myself that I think are awesome.
You're making me think of a quote by jazz musician Shabaka Hutchings, which is a guiding principle for me that communities that have agency are capable of forming their own philosophical structures. And I think what you're describing is sort of the way that concepts are actualized in the world, in community, a circumstance in which those concepts don't operate in the realm of ideas, if there were such a thing as that, but rather mobilize change, effect change in the world. Or world build, right? I mean, it's kind of a process of world building itself.
Mm-hmm.
I want to highlight the fact that during this conversation, you've been standing the whole time. And and again, I mean, just how like not forgetting that we are not just disembodied voices. and I kind of love that.
Yeah, the visual description of me would be like a person wearing headphones and a sweatshirt, standing in the basement, flapping her hands and rocking a lot.
That's great. And I'll agree with the accuracy of that statement, that description. I'm enjoying talking with you so much. Thanks for being here. I mentioned to you before we had this conversation that I am asking all of the guests to ask a question for the other guests. And I'm going to break my own rule a little bit. Not that it's an actual rule, it's just an implied rule. But I'm going to ask you the question that our last guest on the show, Christina, asked. I'll ask you that eventually, but in the same reason that I brought up Dorothy before, because of the relationship to open source software, I want to ask you the question that Dorothy asked, because it feels highly relevant in this conversation as well, which is there a role for forgetting in the future? And Dorothy asked that because of the way, essentially, that contemporary social media technology, internet culture, and the culture of computation sets up these really ingrained pathways and grooves that define and record and observe a lot of social life, private life, our habits, the habits of contemporary living human beings. And so in response to that, Dorothy kind of wondered out loud if there could be a role of forgetting in the future that could positively intervene in such a circumstance, particularly in the way like that the idea of forgetting is fraught with so much baggage, which you brought up too a little while ago. And this, I don't want to make it a binary double-edged blade question, because it's clearly much more than that. But you have, on the one hand, the risk of forgetting, which is partially defined by the fascism, bigotry, xenophobia that has reared itself in the moment right now, that has a residue of Nazi Germany, and also the capacity of forgetting, perhaps as a way of unlearning so that one can relearn.
I think my approach to this question is, I don't remember most stuff. But last night, my husband and I were watching a YouTube video of these guys doing this bike race in Denver, and he paused the video And he was like, at this intersection, when we lived in Denver, he told me this whole amazing story about this thing that happened at this intersection, this bike store, this whole thing he remembered. And I remember never having lived there, basically. So there's this, there's one of the great things about forgetting is that we all forget in different ways. And then we get to sort of experience the world freshly through someone else's story. And sometimes those stories, like you were saying about the current moment, sometimes those stories I forget intentionally in order to gain power. But sometimes, you know, when you're looking at a worldview where there's no central story, sometimes forgetting your own story leaves you open to other people's story. And I definitely experience that a lot as a highly forgetting human. But I would also say that one of the other advantages of my memory loss is I don't remember my traumas. So like, I can tell you the story of like, when I was 10 years old, I died. And then I was resuscitated and I had a brain injury. This is the story I tell about the thing because I don't remember any of this. And so when it comes to processing my traumas and sort of relearning how to live with a traumatized nervous system and a traumatized body, I get to address now. I get to be like, right now, my brain is doing this thing and we need to do this strategy to help it. I don't end up in this sort of like quagmire of reliving the thing I don't remember. And I actually think that strategy can be super useful for addressing like bigger cultural traumas. Because instead of like readdressing this thing that already happened that we can't change, and I don't want us to forget it happened, but instead of focusing on it, can we just be like, this is the thing that's happening right now that we need to change. And here are some strategies that we have shown effectively change that thing. And for me in my life, like that's been really useful. And I don't want to say like, we should never talk about slavery again. That is not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that like, when a Black person says, hey, this thing is affecting my life right now, I need it to be fixed, we all just go, okay, that is the thing that's happening right now. How do we fix it? Like, it's a very, just like in the moment, like personal, interactive, like how's your body currently feeling, how's other person's body currently feeling, and how can we address that right now with the tools that we have. So I can't redress history, but I can act right now to solve problems that are happening right now. It doesn't erase what caused them. Like, it's not like the fact that I forgot that my brain injury happened means that the repercussions are go away. That's not true. But I don't have to focus on like, this company did this thing that was neglectful and they didn't do maintenance and now I have this brain. Like, I never think about that. I just think about like, oh, well, need to take meds, need to put my oxygen tank on, need to like do strategies that affect me right now. The downside to that would be like, well, are we learning from the past then? And I don't know. Like, I don't know if that strategy would mean that we aren't learning from the past, but I do know that in my life personally, it has let me be more in the moment, both for other people's needs and for my own.
Thanks for taking on what is a very complex question and sharing a kind of vulnerable, though perhaps maybe less vulnerable for you due to not remembering certain things.
Yeah. It doesn't feel, it doesn't have the immediacy that other people would expect it to have for me because I don't remember. So I don't carry like an emotional load into telling people about it because it's just like, well, these are some facts about frogs. Would you like the frog facts?
I appreciate your sense of humor. we got about 10 minutes left. Since you brought up this coping mechanism for the now, maybe those are my words, but maybe that describes mm-hmm. a little bit of what you were saying. I've been wanting to ask you what you're working on right now. What is that? What are you working on in this current moment?
So I am working on two projects. One of them I mentioned a little bit earlier, which is a drawing, a hybrid drawing practice. For the drawing practice, I've been building this experiment that exposed the same process to multiple different environments. So I exposed the same process to sort of my home environment and my disabled lifestyle, which is a very like static indoor kind of experience. And then I also exposed the same process to my mother's disabled lifestyle, because we're both disabled. when she lives in an RV, this very like mobile outdoor living environment. And I was interested in if I can expose a process to multiple different sort of disabled lifestyles, what do those differences in lifestyle mean to image making and how do they affect image making? Because as I, you know, I mentioned earlier, like I'm interested in ways of knowing. And so I wanted to create one project that had two very different environmental processes baked into them. So I'm working on that right now. And then I'm also working on my next computational prosthetic. And this prosthetic is called Synthetic Self. Synthetic Self is a 2-year-ish long experiment in creating a copycat AI. So this AI looks like me and talks like me and has all of my data and can answer questions with emotional variation. So that means that I can ask it things and it can answer sort of like the way that you're seeing me in a video now. You would be able to see this synthetic version of me in a video and ask it questions about itself slash me using my data. And we are developing right now an emotional behavior tree model, which will be completely in-house. It's not based on open source, but we will open source it. And this behavior tree model will be able to modify the emotional state of the AI based on what it's talking about. So we're trying to build this stable version of me. And what I mean by stable is that my disability is highly variable. I can be nonverbal. I can be paralyzed on half the side of my body. I can be, you know, completely unable to function in a dark room with no sound. I have a very high range of functionality. But there's this idea in the world that there is a normal, that there is a person who is non-disabled and not autistic and not queer, all of these not-not-nots. And so I wanted to experiment with, like, what do I look like in that fantasy world? And can I build it using AI? And I had this idea because I had an interview with a museum and it was scheduled at a time that they couldn't reschedule and I couldn't talk. And I was like, well, I guess we're doing a video call where they talk and I just type in the chat. And then I was thinking about, like, if a prosthetic for me in that situation would be essentially like a puppet that I could make talk that sounds like me and looks like me, how far could I push that to really like be a prosthetic self, not a prosthetic limb or a prosthetic memory, but literally a prosthetic self that I could project onto a computer screen into other environments. So that's what I'm currently working on. It will probably be done in like 2025.
I really love that you didn't use the word avatar to describe that, because it seems like the idea of an avatar is something that's been so somewhere less than abused and somewhere more than overused in terms of what it means to mediate an entity into another space. That seems inadequate to articulate what you have described here. And how did that interview go?
I thought it went better than I expected. They were very patient and kind, which I really appreciated. I think because it wasn't like this where it was being recorded. It was more just like a conversational, they're asking me some questions and things. There wasn't as much pressure on the performative aspect, like speak in a clear tone of voice so on the recording, people in the podcast can hear you. Like there wasn't those necessities that this forum has. I think because the form was kind of lax, because they were very patient and kind, like because of a lot of reasons, it went fine. It brought up that thing that a lot of disabled people experience where it's like, well, this is the only way I can do this, but also the shame button has been pushed and I now feel all the shames. Even though they weren't shaming me, it was still like, I need access in this way and now I feel really shit about it. So I think that's why that experience too really like opened my eyes about what a prosthetic could be. I was like, I don't want my shame button getting pushed. That's stupid. No shame button.
It's not the first time in this conversation that your responses have elicited such complexity in how I'm thinking about the work that you're doing. I'm trying to be really structured in a productive way in terms of guiding a conversation for a group of listeners right? Like in a way that's in a way that a conversation about something like technocultures can be a sensible conversation with through lines and whatnot. The way that you articulate your practice, and I mean this as a compliment, it challenges the capacity of that, because you're bringing up so many rich ways of engaging meaning making. I want for that interview to be a performance. I want for that, like, I'm curious about the way that that interview operates and the way that this visual representation of your synthetic self operates, and the fact that a minute or two ago you described the outcome of the first work you described as being about the images that emerge out of these different processes. And I'm kind of curious about your thinking here of how, what constitutes the meaning object in these different processes, right? Like, it produces a really rich way of considering who's the self in that work that's producing meaning, I guess. Is the synthetic you, is it a mediated you, or is it the meaning itself? Like, does the meaning matter in the synthetic, or is the practice of the synthetic itself the meaning, whether it's like clear in like English written words or not, or like looks like a certain thing? I mean, you used this word before, images, to describe those two previous works. And I guess I was stricken by the way image objects as an outcome mattered to you in that particular context.
Yeah, I definitely think that the meaning is in the process, but the learning is in the object. The process of writing a book is where the meaning and knowledge is, but the book is how I learn about the meaning and knowledge that someone else has produced. The authors don't like read their own books and be like, yes, I learned the thing. Like, that's not how that works. So it's similar for me. Like, the research and production of the knowledge is where the meaning is. It's like, I don't look at prosthetic memory and be like, yes, this highly obfuscated process is really teaching me something. Like, when you look at prosthetic memory, you don't see like the fact that Steve invented from nothing an entirely new way to do synthetic and real data in the same image. Like, you just don't see that at all. But that was like a huge part of the meaning and knowledge making for me, was that part of the process. And it's in like the documentation videos and stuff. But so like, yes, the meaning and knowledge for me is in the process, but the meaning and knowledge for other people is in the object, because they're not there for every second of the process. And you have to make ways for other people to access knowledge without them going through every step you went through, because otherwise we're all just producing the same knowledge all the time. And who wants that?
Does that almost always result in a visual object for you?
Yes, I think I always end up with a visual object, whether that's like a video or a prosthetic or an installation or like a book or prints. Like, yes, I end up with visuals.
I'm going to ask you a really broad question as we're getting towards the end. This is like entering my own mind. It brings together these physical processes. We never got around to talking about your basket weaving, but we've talked a lot about process and physical process. People just have to go to your website to see all that amazing work. What is technocultures for you? Or if you didn't have, if you don't care about that as a term, like what would it be for you?
I think that culture and technoculture are essentially the same thing, and that humans make culture with tools, and humans make tools to make culture. They are in iterative relationship to each other. Sometimes when you make objects with tools, they're considered like fine art, which is usually the label that we put on what I make. And sometimes when you make tools to make culture, or make cultures that make tools, it ends up being like a computer or a house or like a non-art use object. But they're in that same iterative loop. And sometimes you just spin off different things from that loop. So for me, technoculture or culture or whatever you want to call it is the iterative loop of making that humans engage in the world. And whether that's use objects or tools or languages or fashion or dance styles, they're all informing each other in a spiral. When we say like histories, we're generally talking about how those iterative things have influenced each other in terms of objects or styles or events or pandemics. Like all of those things happen in that spiral.
I like that answer. Forks. Forks are a pretty excellent technoculture, I think.
Yeah. Trees.
Yeah.
Both the only problem with the tree metaphor, though, is that like stuff loops back together. Even in genetic trees, we see that like you don't, it's not this perfect like branching, separating thing that like stuff sews itself back together.
Sure. Like mycorrhizal fungus play a big role in that, I think.
Oh, yeah. Mushrooms are so cool.
Yeah, another technoculture. So I want to ask you the question that everyone gets asked. What's your question for the next guest on the show? And let me say why I think that, why I'm doing this, why that's an important question, give you a little context. I think it really matters. It's part of my interest in this podcast. Is I think it matters to bring a really dynamic group of voices in technocultures together. There are so many different modalities, so many different disciplines. There is science and technology studies. There's the big tech industry. There's critical coding. There is security software. There is the arts and technology nonprofit sector. There's a tradition of radical experimental media art. All of these different things kind of coexist in making the world. And I think it's constructive to put different voices together. And I want to know what each of the guests on this show would want to ask other guests. I think that becomes a very interesting way of linking these conversations together. So what question would you have for a guest on this program?
So my question is like a little bit twofold. It's how do disabled people and disability factor into your future? And what accommodations do you need? Even if you don't identify as disabled, like what accommodations do you need? Because I feel like everybody needs something and I want to know what it is.
Thank you for that question. Those are two wonderful questions. The reason why that matters is somewhat self-evident, but would you share why you think that's an important question?
Yeah, in disability research, there's a lot of time spent like defining who is and who is not disabled and taxonomizing like what is and was not as a disability and who is not like has a right to like Medicaid or ramps or access at work. And I think that the more people talk about the things that they need, the more we can detaxonomize need into people who are able-bodied who don't need any help ever, and people who are disabled who need all of this help and they're special and deserving in the patronizing way. For autistic people in the autistic community, we talk about there being a spectrum of autism, and some people are high masking, and some people are low masking, and some people are nonverbal, and some people are not, and some people have high sensory seeking needs or low sensory. So we have this highly developed language around all the kinds of different things that autistic people need. There's not one universal way to be autistic. There's not one universal way to give accessibility to an autistic person. The more I meet people who have PTSD, who have other mental health problems, who feel stress, who have elder care or child care, who felt like they always had to live up to a standard that they never could quite meet. I want to know who you are and what you need, because part of the project of this podcast and part of the project of my art practice is this world building. And if we're building a world in which all of these people are centered in their own lives, like I need to know how to do that for you. Is accessibility there never ever being police violence again? Is accessibility that you need access to clean water? Is accessibility like that you need a basic income? Is it all of those things? Like you have needs and your needs are valuable and we need to know what they are so that we can all learn to meet all of our needs together.
that's, I think, an extraordinarily wise perspective. I think you're illustrating why the world of disability studies, for example, is in fact one of the most radical spaces to challenge what is what we mean when we talk about humanity.
Uh-huh.
Because it's doing all of that work that you just described, and that is important in every context of life, not the least of which is this trauma-informed perspective of healing that you're talking about that is so absent from the normative Western culture. And you've also made the question that Christina asked last month, which is the question I'm going to ask to you. I wanted to ask you Dorothy's question because it seems so relevant to our conversation. But again, if I'm to follow the non-verbalized rules that I've made for myself in this show.
Very important.
My last guest on the show was Christina Steinbrecher-Fant, whose name I am poorly pronouncing for the second time. She's the executive director and founder of blockchain.art, which is a platform for the fine art market for archiving and for minting crypto art. So she asked, in light of 2021, where the ultimate conversation was about money, money carried value defined by the market, she says, this is not her defining characteristic, but the market's defining characteristic. Her question is, how do the participants of this podcast define success for themselves? What does success look like in whatever you strive to do? And frankly, I'm so glad I'm asking you this question in light of the question that you just asked.
I have two. One of them is intrinsic and one of them is extrinsic. I like external validation. I like being on podcasts. I like people looking at my work. I like talking about my work with other people. I like when people give me awards for doing cool things. Extrinsic motivation is awesome. I consider it part of my success. The intrinsic motivation is, if I don't make art, I literally don't know how to function. I don't understand the world unless I'm making art. And so for me, success is just keep doing it. If I am still doing this until like 95 years old, then I will have been extremely successful because I will have spent my whole life developing practices and sharing practices with others that help me understand the world. Because if I don't do that, bad things happen to my brain if I try to stop. Yeah, part of success for me is like other people think you're doing cool stuff and they invite you on their podcast. And then part of success for me is just like, keep going, just keep going. Please just keep going. Like, I know you hate the thing you're working on right now and you don't know why. And you're on the 20th iteration and we have to keep making iterations until you get to the 50th one, because by then you'll think it's amazing. And then you'll be able to write this whole thing about the process. Like, just keep going. And if I can, that's success. Especially if I write in my journal like, this is stupid and I hate it, and then like 3 weeks later I'm like, I did it, yes, I kept going through that struggle. Love it. Yeah, those are my two success metrics.
Great. Totally great, thanks. There was more.
Just keep swimming,
you know. More body movements were happening on the the video screen of this podcast that only the two of us are experiencing. And thank you so much for joining me. It's been a real pleasure having this conversation with you.
Yeah, this is great. Thanks for having me.
To everyone who's listening, visit blinkpopshift.com to see Em's work over the years. There's a lot of different types of work on there that'll give you all visual senses of what these processes we've been discussing look like. My name's Elijah Vargas. The Signal Podcast is a project by the Goethe Institute in collaboration with Gray Area and the Sea Change Initiative. Signals is a monthly podcast released with the Signals digital magazine at seachange.xyz/signals. Thanks, everyone. Until next time.